So you're back in Oklahoma. Talk about the collapse of the oil boom in here, the collapse of Penn Square Bank. We have many bankruptcies. Bring us into that era.
Well, it was sort of interesting. I come back. All the oil men that had hated Jimmy Carter. I mean, Carter had a few people who voted for him in 1976 because Carter was more modest than some. He talked about gas prices and so on. But by the time he had done the windfall profits tax and he had the disaster in Iran, there wasn't an oil man in America that was for him. And one of the things he had done, and I was in the midst of all these things we did, one of the things we did is we passed a bill called the Natural Gas Policy Act. It was the first step to gas deregulation, and Carter got no credit for it. Carter also started the deregulation of oil. He got blamed for the regulation of oil, but the regulation of oil had been done by Nixon, and he inherited it. In fact, Schlesinger had a big role in Carter taking the position that we're going to deregulate. Reagan got credit for deregulating oil when it was Carter that did it. And the Natural Gas Policy Act was the first act that, you remember, it deregulated deep gas, caused all those problems. Well, the guy who regulated gas was Eisenhower. It was very unfair, the treatment. But anyway, I come back, and the oil men are rich as Croesus. The word was that there was a millionaire every day in Oklahoma City. There were something like 2,000 new companies in Oklahoma, all of them making money hand over fist. I mean, and I came back and went into partnership with my uncle in an oil business, and it was fun. I mean, money was flowing in. You could get wells drilled. The first year, this would have been 1982. The first year, okay, we drilled 25 wells. You know, we were a three-man company. We didn't have an engineer. What happened was is that when I got out of Washington, we'd had the big energy price spike because of the Iranian crisis. When Ayatollah Khomeini came in, the country shut down. So there were 4 million barrels a day taken off the market immediately. This was like 1979, 80. That 4 million barrels a day drove the prices up to over $40. When I came back, oil was $38 and beginning to sink. And between that time and 1985, it had sunk, you know, like $15. So we were at a point where even a decent small well was losing money. And in that period, then Penn Square Bank suffered. They made these loans based on a valuation of the oil, and when the oil value declined, every loan was in default. Every loan in America, oil and gas loan. They didn't know what to do. The oil men didn't know what. Nobody knew what to do. I mean, Exxon had projected that oil prices would continue to raise. I was privy to the Exxon projections before I came back from Washington in 1981, and they were totally wrong. Everyone was wrong, and so everyone was caught out. They had borrowed all this money based on $40 oil, and it was now $10. So everybody was bankrupt. Penn Square started it, and it just dominoed, and we had a terrible bloodletting, which I always thought was sort of ironic, because under Reagan, the industry never suffered more than during the Reagan years. And Reagan was really partly responsible for that. One of the things that Reagan was very proud of doing was driving oil prices down and thus cutting off the cash to OPEC and cutting off the cash to Russia. The country that suffered the most from the price declines was Russia. When Brezhnev was president of Russia, oil was at $40. Which is the equivalent of about $100 now. What happened was is that Brezhnev was replaced by Gorbachev. Oil prices went into the toilet, and Gorbachev got caught with an incredible deficit. Reagan and Schultz were laughing all the way to the bank because here America's great adversary was unable to pay the bills. And then at the same time, Reagan upped the ante by advocating Star Wars. So the Russians were in a terrible bind. And if you will look at the situation with Gorbachev, poor Gorbachev was in there during that period of time. Those oil prices were just totally. And so the Russian net receipts were cut in half or more. So when I come back, I get into oil business. Oil's $38. We drill a bunch of wells. We're doing fine. All of a sudden, oil goes down to $10, $15, and we just barely hang on. Really, one of my greatest accomplishments is that I was able to go through that era without going bankrupt. I mean, there were 2,000 Oklahoma companies that went bankrupt. We hadn't borrowed any money, and we operated, which meant you can always make $150 to $200 a well by operating. And we didn't have a lot of overhead. And at one time, we cut all of our employees back by 10%. And my partner and I forwent any kind of pay ourselves. So we managed to make it through these bad times up until 96. And then he was getting older, and we just sold the company out in 96. And when we sold it out, oil was $18.
You were the trustee for many of those failed companies, weren't you?
Well, this was a bit of luck that really helped me put bread on the table during these bad times. I had done some bankruptcy work before, and I was asked by a bankruptcy judge to take over a small company that had five wells down around Okmulgee. I managed to get it turned around and get a buyer for it and all this business. And I told the judge, a little more business like that and I'll really be starving to death, because it was a labor of love. So maybe because of that comment, the next time one comes down the pike, he calls me again. And this is the Kenneth Turow bankruptcy, which was probably one of the more flamboyant cases ever in Oklahoma history. Turow had been sort of a con man. He was an All-American honorable mention football player from Michigan State, Tank Turow, T-U-R-E-A-U. He started off with a sort of a swindle of other NFL football players. These were swindles in the sense that everyone claimed they were swindled, but they weren't necessarily prosecuted. And then he went into something else, and the SEC barred him from any further trading and so on. So he had this terrible record. In fact, we figured out that the day he came to Oklahoma, he had been turned down for financing a Chevrolet in Ann Arbor, where he lived. But this hadn't prevented him from buying a lot of stuff. He had a 15-bedroom home in Palm Springs. He had thousands of acres out in New Mexico. He had lots of acreage here in Tulsa. He came down here to get in the oil business, and he managed to borrow $30 million from Penn Square Bank. He did it based on a little field down here around Okmulgee that I ended up operating, and after much difficulty, I was able to sell it for $1 million. But he went into Penn Square Bank, and I think there was some payoffs involved. He would buy horses from people for, $750,000. He was sort of a charming guy in a way. He was a charismatic guy, but very sort of spooky. He and I developed an interesting relationship. He finally was killed in a car wreck. He was a huge drinker. He was the kind who would pass out in his plate. But anyway, he had, at the time of his bankruptcy, maybe 15 corporations, which I pierced the corporate veil on all of them. He had $27 million worth of quarter horses. Nobody has ever had a lock on the quarter horse mares like Ken Turow. Well, before I was actually appointed, and during the period of time he was wrestling around with the court, he was able to lay off a good 20 million of them. Of course, a lot of these were very high dollar. So when I took it over, he had $3 million worth of quarter horse mares all over the country. And one of my greatest accomplishments was to pick up every one of those horses. Mares you don't keep on your own place. Mares you send out where the stud farms are. So he had no ranch. He just had his horses stationed. They were in 11 states. And, of course, I had a great bankruptcy lawyer, Sam Bratton, and also had Gary McDonald, two of the best bankruptcy lawyers in the country right now. Actually, most of them cut their teeth on my cases. But anyway, you show up at a ranch in Montana and the guy's owed $10,000 for hay by a guy in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and you come up to pick up the horse, it's pretty hard to do that. We got them all picked up and we had a big auction down in Oklahoma City. We got the Ruidoso Super Select, which is probably the biggest, fanciest quarter horse sale operation in America. One of the mistakes I made was that I didn't charge admission for this. So many people came. It filled up the biggest sale operation, one of the biggest in America. Filled it up, and a lot of the bidders were out in the hallways.
In Oklahoma City.
It's down in Oklahoma City, and I've forgotten what this place is called. I had the Brinks guards there. We got about $3 million out of that one night. We would have gotten more, except when we announced our auction, a couple of other people who were bankrupt ran in and conducted auctions the day before. But anyway, I had several auctions for Turow. I ended up settling one of the big cases that he had. He had a lot of real estate, was not paid for, and so forth. And I ended up making a 15, 20 cent on the dollar distribution. But, I had to hire a U-Haul to take all of his Picassos and his Ruaults and all his other art up to New York City. We sold it at Sotheby's. I had an auction out here at the fairgrounds, an all-day auction. He had three airplanes, one of which had been John Wayne's airplane, and had these expandable rubber tanks that you use when you're bringing drugs in from Mexico. It was just an exotic thing, and he was sort of an exotic kind of guy. And then he got a crony to come in and propose a reorganization. This guy's name was Negrelli. He had a very checkered reputation, and so I made it a point to have somebody in the room when I talked to Negrelli. And he left the room and went right out and had a press conference with the Tulsa Tribune, in which he said that he had offered me $50 million or whatever it was, and that I turned it down because I wanted to continue to get fees in the bankruptcy case. Well, what he didn't mention was that there was not cash. These were letters of credit from a bank that was so unknown, I was never able to find anybody who had ever heard of this bank. So he had $50 million worth of letters of credit from, you know, the Kuwaiti First State Bank. I mean, it was the most palpable bit of fraud I've ever seen. Negrelli later showed his colors down in Texas in a couple of big deals. Anyway, so I got rid of Cantoro with pretty good results. In fact, the real crown jewels, he had a huge area of real estate down in Florida in Jupiter Island, which is a lot of the wealthy hangouts. He had a big subdivision down there, and I had to sell that and manage it. But he owned 200 acres at the corner of 91st and Memorial. I had to sell that, and I broke that up into pieces and sold that, and I got about $20 million off of that. When it was all over, he had debts of $90 million. I think we might have gotten $25 million back. That was probably the most interesting case.
Where was Cantoro from?
He was from Michigan.
Did he live in Oklahoma?
No. What he did is he'd gotten such a bad reputation. SEC had brought an action against him. He was a larger-than-life character. I'll tell you how he got his gas contract from Phillips. He called Phillips and said, "I've got all this gas, and I want to sell it to you." Phillips said, "Well, you know, we're not that interested. I want to come up." Cantoro had a limousine, one of these white stretch limousines, and he drives it up to Bartlesville, loaded with his aides and so forth. Well, these people in Bartlesville were up there in that office building, and when Cantoro drove, they're all looking out of their windows, and they see this guy get out, and he's got cowboy boots, and he's got long sideburns, very powerful guy. They say, "Who in this guy?" And he had purchased $14 million worth of pipe from Nucorp. Or maybe $5 million, but it was a huge amount of pipe, and it was all 14-inch pipe. And nobody ships gas through 14-inch pipe unless you're shipping it down from the North Slope or something. But he had all this 14-inch pipe stacked down here in Okmulgee. Of course, he hadn't paid for that either. That was his demonstration, and then, of course, he had a reserve study saying that this field down here by Davis had all this oil and gas. And then he had the $30 million loan, so he was able to turn that around and get this big contract with Phillips. He was one of these kind of guys, when he moved into town, he took an entire floor of the Williams Tower and had all the furniture made, handmade, for him. I had a hard time getting it out of there and selling it. He had a deal down in New Mexico where he and Jimmy Connors were going to have this big tennis club, and at the same time they were going to have the Ruidoso races brought in by television, and he owned all these thousands of acres out there. And all this stuff was bought on credit. He was the most amazing guy. Like I say, when he bought that $30 million, we found out he'd been turned down by a bank in Michigan for a car loan. But it was a showboat thing. He would go to the Super Bowl, he'd fill up the plane with his buddies, and he'd have these girls dressed up like stewardesses. He had all these hangers on. He was sort of the prototypical boom kind of guy. His own personal cook, who was a guy he had picked up in Germany, who was a real smart kid. As they went on, he turned more and more stuff over to this kid. And he owned a big cowboy bar down in Oklahoma City, you know, the kind where they drank the champagne out of the boot.
But he did live in Tulsa for a time?
Yeah. Well, he lived in so many places, but he had many, many houses in Tulsa. But no, his real residence, he had sort of a ranch, elegant farm up in Ann Arbor. He had this huge house right next to Ivan Lendl's house in Palm Beach. I had an aerial photo of it. I could never go in it because it was exempt. It had 14 bedrooms. It looked like a small college from the air. And then he had some big stuff out in New Mexico. He always would take from Peter to pay Paul, and he was always refinancing and buying. His companies were called Sackett Petroleum.
How did you get connected with that case?
Appointed by the bankruptcy judge.
Did he make any waves in Tulsa?
There was an awful lot of newspaper. If you go back, there was a huge amount of newspaper stories because at first they were trying to untangle this web of corporations. One of his tricks was to have like three different corporations, and they would all be the same name, but they would be incorporated in different states. So you could never find out what corporation you were dealing with, whether it was the New Mexican Corporation or the... Anyway, when that case was over, it took a long time to work out. I then got asked to take over the bankruptcy involving the Republic cases, partly because I'd had this good result in the Turow case. I was a successor trust to a fellow by the name of Jones, who had been the original trustee, but was old and wasn't in good health. And so I took that case over, and that case took 10 years to wrap up.